भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्यं नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयामुदीरये अष्टष्पायशोपदेशु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवती उत्तम श्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्टकी। So we are reading from the conclusions of the Canto 10, Chapter 90. This is the last chapter, entitled Summary of Lord Krishna's Glories. And we will read text 8 and 9 here, but it will go on till 14, so we'll just read the translations after that. Upagiyamano Gandharvair Mridanga Panavakanan Vadayabhir Mudavanam Vinam Vadayabhir Mudavinam Suta Mugadha Vandibhi Only the first one is okay. Upagayamano Gandharvai Mridanga Panavankanam Vadayabhir Mudavinam Suta Magadha Vandibhi Upagayamano Gandharvai Mridanga Panavanakan Vadayabhir Mudavinam Suta Magadha Vandibhi Vandibhi Upagiyamano Gandharvai Mridanga Panavanakan Vadayabhir Mudavinam Suta Magadha Vandibhi Matajis Upagiyamano Gandharvai Midanga Panavanakan Vadayabhir Mudavinam Suta Magadha Vandibhi Yamana Gandhara Midanga Panavanakan Vadayabhir Mudavinam Suta Magadha Vandibhi Upagiyamana Gandharvai Mridanga Panavanakan Vadayabhir Mudavinam Suta Magadha Vandibhi Upagiyamana Being glorified by song Gandharvai, by Gandharvas, Mridanga Panava Anakan, Mridanga, Panava and Anaka drums. Vadayabhi, who were playing? Muda. This is Muda, sorry, Muda. Joyfully. Vinam. Vinas. Suta Magadha Vandivi. By Suta, Magadha and Vandi reciters. Sichyamanaha, being squirted with water. Achyuta, Lord Krishna. Tabhi, by them, his wives. Hasanti bhi, who were laughing. Sma, indeed. Rechakai, with syringes. Pratishinchan, squirting back at them. Vichikride, he sported. Yakshibhi, with Yakshi nymphs. Yaksharat, the lord of the Yakshas, and that is Kuvera. Eva, like. Since these are two combined verses, they've only put one here, so the transliteration was for both the verses. So translation also is for both, 8 and 9. As Gandharva's joyfully, the humble disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Translation. As Gandharva joyfully sang his praises to the accompaniment of Mridanga, Panava and Anaka drums, and as professional reciters known as Sutas, Magadhas and Vandis played Veenas and recited poems praising him, Lord Krishna would play with his wives in the water. Laughing, the queens would squirt water on him with syringes and he would squirt them back. Thus Krishna would sport with his queens in the same way that the lord of the Yakshas sports with the Yakshi nymphs. Text 10, translation. Under the drenched clothing of the queens, their thighs and breasts would become visible. The flowers tied in their large braids would scatter as they sprayed water on their consort. And on the plea of trying to take away his syringe, they would embrace him. By his touch, their lusty feelings would increase, causing their faces to beam with smiles. Thus Lord Krishna's queens shone with resplendent beauty. Text 11. Lord Krishna's flower garland would become smeared with kumkum from their breasts, and his abundant locks of hair would become disheveled as a result of his absorption in the game. As the Lord repeatedly sprayed his young consorts and they sprayed him in turn, he enjoyed himself like the king of elephants, enjoying in the company of his bevy of she-elephants. Text 12, translation. Afterward, Lord Krishna and his wives would give the ornaments and clothing which they had worn during their water sports to the male and female performers who earned their livelihood from singing and from playing instrumental music. Text 13. In this way, Lord Krishna would sport with his queens, totally captivating their hearts with his gestures, talks, glances and smiles, and also with his jokes, playing exchanges and embraces. Text 14. The queens would become stunned in ecstatic trance, their minds absorbed in Krishna alone. Then, thinking of their lotus-eyed Lord, they would speak as if insane. Please hear these words from me as I relate them. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that this superficial appearance of insanity in Lord Krishna's queens, as if they had become intoxicated by Dhatura or some other hallucinogenic drug, was in fact the manifestation of the sixth progressive stage of pure love of Godhead, technically known as Prema Vaichitriya. Srila Rupa Goswami refers to this variety of anurag in his Ujjwal Ninamani, 15.134. Priyasya sannikarshapi premotkarsha swabhavataha ya vishilesha dhyartistat prema vaichitram uchyate. When, as a natural byproduct of one's extreme love, one feels the distress of separation, even in the direct presence of the beloved, this state is called prema vaichitra. Om Agyan Tamirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namah Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Tinamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschata Deshatarine. So, we are actually now hearing about some of the most intimate and lofty topics that of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. So, certainly, I am not qualified to speak on that, but fortunately, we have heard and understood how at least we should address this, how we are able to, how we should look at and try to understand these verses, and so that gives better understanding and confidence. So, a little bit first about the way we approach this. Actually, everything depends upon the way we perceive things, and that depends on our consciousness and how we have been explained or taught. So, in the context of, there are so many examples, like a child would look at things differently because it's too small, consciousness is less, not educated, and but when it grows up, then it looks at it in a different way. And then understands that that is because the level of understanding was at that level, at that age, was very different. So in the same way, we are children trying to understand. So we try to see it from the eyes of Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. So there are many dimensions to this. Because why it is very important? Because otherwise we could clearly misconceive, and even with a very sincere heart we may be hearing, but if you interpret it in a different way, either some words or some sentences or the context, then it could be detrimental to our spiritual life. So that's why it becomes very important first that we try to, even if we think we know, it's better to repeatedly make sure that we understand in what way. So one dimension is, of course, who is speaking this. I mean, first of all, it is in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So who wrote the Srimad Bhagavatam? We know Lord Vyasadeva, who is the literary incarnation of Krishna, and how he came to write about it. Why is it called the summum bonum of all literatures? Because he had written so many scriptures, all the vast nectar of scriptures that Vyasadeva had written, and yet actually being the literary incarnation of the Lord, that was his presentation. That's the way Krishna wanted scriptures to be presented to the world. But in spite of that, he was feeling emptiness, and through that, then his Guru Maharaj Narad Muni came and explained to him that you have written so many scriptures, but all of them are, there's a tinge of either Gyan Kand or Ashtanga Kand. So, therefore, you have not yet addressed the pure unalloyed devotional service activities of the Lord, and then Srimad Bhagavatam is the result, which is considered to be the non-different than Krishna. So that is one aspect of it. Then who is the reciter who actually presents it to Parikshit Maharaj? Parikshit Maharaj was given 7 days to live. He goes to the banks, and the assembly of all the thousands of the greatest sages through, and it is not that it was just one generation, it is across many yugas. Vyasadeva himself was there, and Narad Muni was there, and everybody, all the sages assembled. And in that, Sukhdev Goswami Maharaj was asked to speak. So we can consider who Sukhdev Goswami Maharaj was. And we also know that being the son of Vyasadeva, he chose to come out of the womb only when he was 16 years old. He chose the right time, and when he came out, he just straight away walked to the forest because he was already completely self-realized. This personality, who was the youngest among the assembly of sages, was asked to speak. So that, and then this personality, who is actually the Parikshukha in Krishna's Leela, is constantly has stressed repeatedly, not only him but through the parampara, all the great sages, including Srila Prabhupada, have been stressing that the Srimad Bhagavatam contains the highest level of understanding. Within that also, we have to go progressively from Canto 1 to Canto 10. Canto 10 is, we should not jump to Canto 10. And that also, Canto 10 contains the pastimes which are, these transcendental pastimes are the purest and most intense expressions of spiritual love, that there's not even a tinge of any material conceptions in this. So, because we may see it from our own faulty perceptions, and that is why we have to see it from the eyes of the Shastra. So this is where we are at, that these wonderful pastimes are enacted by the Lord. Now this comes under his sporting with his wives, is also part of the Madhurya Ras. So, a little bit about these five rasas also we need to understand, that actually Prabhupada says that these five rasas, or the five relationships, even in the material world they exist. The five rasas, that is Shantaras, Dasyaras, that is the neutrality stage of Dasya as a servant, servitorship, friendship, parental or filial love, and conjugal love, or between husband, wife, or lover and beloved. This exists also in the material world. But this is a perverted reflection of the real relationships with the transcendental relationship with Krishna. And why is that? We'll come to in a moment. But first let's examine how these relationships remain in our lives. Because in present, because we see that, of course, in our Shastras, the first, that is the Shantaras, is considered the least important. Because the minute there is any exchange, slightest exchange between the knower and the known, immediately transcendental loving exchanges and they start taking place, which automatically means the active proponent, so it becomes a service. Prabhupada explained that in the Western world, the Shantaras gains prominence because of the power of creation. But in Vedic scriptures, real relationships start from Dasyaras onwards. So here in the material world, we have everyone, most of us, I think everybody practically will consider that they are servants. Mother is a servant to, is doing service, let's say, doing service to the family, children. Father is doing that. Then in our occupation also, we are serving our employers. The employer is serving his shareholders, and he's serving the government, he's serving the civic, the city. The bureaucrats are also considered being public servants. Then even the prime minister and president of a country would consider that they are servants of, see, these are quote unquote supposed to be servants, but they are publicly known as servants of the janta or the people, because that is how democracy is supposed to work, that they are elected to serve the public. So, in fact, we may not know, but we may be spending 10 hours a day as in dasyaras, in the material world. Then even in friendship, everybody has friends from childhood. We have friends at all stages. We go to movies together, we go to clubs together, we spend time discussing business, politics, whatever, you know, so many things. So everyone has their own circles of friends. Parents, of course, the mother will serve the family and the child. The father is also serving, and he works very hard to get money for the family. So these are extensions of the material reflection of Vatsalya Ras. And of course, the husband, wife, lover, beloved, there's no shortage of them. But then and in fact, in the material world, sex is the main binding principle that really becomes very attractive. So that is the running cord between male-female relationship, by and large, in an overwhelming majority of the cases in the material world. It's just beyond a certain age, the thoughts also seemingly inexorably, you know, move towards the opposite sex. That's the nature of the material world. But why is it considered the perverted reflection? Because, first of all, these are all, in the material world, these are all temporary, and they often end in serious problems, sorrows, setbacks, anxieties. For instance, we may say we are serving, but say an occupation, for instance, there are many service, in fact, most countries now, those whose economy has more income from service rather than manufacturing, agriculture, is considered to be more advanced. So most of the income comes from services. So whether it is at petrol pumps or whether it's at restaurants, airlines, banking, insurance, hotels, places to stay, etc. People are in restaurants, shops, and big stores. So most people are employed in, say, the biggest company in the world, Walmart, alone has some 1.5 million people, employees. So now they are all, but the minute you don't give them pay, nobody is going to work. And even those who are paying, being paid, would like to progress, get promoted, right? That's the whole objective. So the service is a technique. It is not from the heart. It is really something which is necessary, whether you like it or not, as part of your occupation. And everyone's desire is to see that the advancement in organizations mean that they need to serve less people and be served by more. You start with where you have to serve everyone and you resent it. You go up the ladder, you want to serve less people, and you go at the highest, then you are served by others, though officially you say you are serving. So that, therefore, we can see that it is a superficial level and it doesn't remain without the commercial element in it. There isn't any other solid, and it is temporary, therefore. Similarly, friendships also. Friends come and go. You know, our school friends now, many of us may be in touch with our early friends in childhood and school and college. And we may still have, you know, we may meet once in a while, and we do have those days will of course remain, you know, what was there so many years ago. It was in a different time. But we see suddenly there's very little in common. So you, for that brief moments you meet, so therefore new friends have come. And therefore it is without the context of spiritual substance, the relationships would be very fleeting and would be at a superficial level and certainly would be temporary. Often it turns into enemies, friends would become enemies, there would be arguments and so on. But even if it doesn't, you may drift apart, you may not meet so often, and the same intensity of feeling when you were sitting, your best friend sitting next to you on the bench in school, now you don't have that same intensity in most cases because there isn't, or you don't meet so often, and future has changed for people. Similarly, with parents also, in today's world, The parents have a hard time even controlling their children. Children have their own views and how they would want to go about. So therefore, that kind of serene atmosphere where there is loving reciprocation is not so much to find, and whatever little is there is also reducing. So it's especially in the other parts of the world. At least where there is a family unit in India, there is some, but again there is with its it has its challenges here. The conjugal, that is the relationship of husband-wife or lover and beloved, there's so many divorces, live-in relationships, contracts. So it has again turned into an individualistic approach where we see what is beneficial to me, and if it also suits you, then wonderful, we are together. But after some time, if it doesn't suit me or if our views clash, then I have to see about myself first. So it's always about myself first, and then there may be extended family, but then after some time, if everyone's views are different, then I'll see that my priority is myself. So this approach will be extended through, so therefore these remain very fleeting. So the bottom line is that in these are imperfect and incomplete, because the object is imperfect and incomplete. The object is ourselves, in one sense or the other. Even if you are saying that somebody is serving the nation, but it is serving his own conception of, on a bodily level, on his own conception of what pleases him. It is a subtle sense gratification where you may get respect for yourself or for some people you love. It may be a family or community. So I'm not saying that that should not be there. We are not saying that this should be devoid of it. But we are saying that what we are considering, what are the factual aspect of relationships that exist, and the intensity with which we develop only this relationship above everything else, that becomes a problem. Ultimately, we are in society, and whether we are in the ashram or outside, if we are preaching, if we are in the ashram, we are preaching, and if we are outside, we of course are working outside or living with family. So we are obviously meeting so many people most of the time. So definitely we have to evolve and understand from our spiritual context how we should relate with everyone. But at all times, in fact, to see that the benefit of, whatever benefit we can derive from little advancement in spiritual life that we may have made, that actually it helps us to improve our relationship with others. So here we are looking at just the to understand that a complete means at least the temporariness and the fleeting nature of relationships in this material world, as opposed to the everlasting transcendental relationship with Krishna. Because our scriptures say that, our guru says that, our shastras say that, that Krishna is our well-wisher and he is the only true friend, because he is eternal and our relationship is eternal on the spiritual level, whether we are in this body or any other body. So how we can keep that relationship uppermost, and how we can dovetail that understanding into our activities is really the nature, and how our attitude is will actually depend, means the depending on our attitude we'll be able to if we feel that we need help and we are always looking for it and we are wanting the security and shelter of association, then to that extent we will benefit. So looking to the relationships that we are there, important to recognize this. So therefore when we look at Shastra, when we read, when we are understanding the wonderful nature of the sporting relationship between Krishna and his wives, or when we look at Krishna and the gopis, we really see that with not a tinge of any material conception whatsoever, and is on the highest, purest level of spiritual, entirely spiritual relationship, where there is a deep expression of love, where the love is completely selfless, is only to, but the manifestations are in different ways, and those manifestations we may not perceive, we may not understand, because we are not at that level. So having said that, we look at what are the challenges of understanding that. It's important that we understand that Lord Krishna, actually when he descends here to this world, There's always a purpose. There are some primary purposes, some not so obvious purposes. But a key purpose is that he is establishing the true relationship, because we have these temporary relationships with others, but he actually, by manifesting these pastimes in Vrindavan, we are seeing how Krishna actually demonstrates the true relationships. He gives us an opportunity to stop the imitation relationships that we have, or not stop, but at least to improve that and recognize the temporariness, and actually understand from Krishna's activities in Vrindavan what are the true relationships. And then when Krishna has already finished, then he disappears from this time. So that is a key aspect of his descent here. So we can come to the aspect of why do we find these challenges of understanding. And again, our shastras tell us that whether we recognize this or not, a key element of our weakness is really the nature of envy. And we may say, I'm not envious of Krishna, but actually we may not be directly envious of Krishna, but the basic stem of our insecurity because ultimately, if we do not accept Krishna in totality, that means Krishna in everyone, including people we don't like, then actually his powers. Because ultimately Krishna is behind every person, everyone's strengths, everyone's talent, whatever somebody has succeeded, so even our competitors, wherever whatever we are doing, it may be even among our devotional circles, among devotees, that we see that Krishna is actually. So if we recognize that, if we don't recognize that, then clearly it is somewhere or the other we are envious of Krishna's means how Krishna manifests in other people's lives in different ways. So we may see that Krishna is there when we are chanting, when we come to the temple, or when we are hearing a satsang program, we are hearing a lecture. But we differentiate that from the time when we look at somebody where we have a very antagonistic relationship, competitive relationship, or we don't like someone. It may not be someone's style, or it may be someone whom we feel is not worthy of getting some success. But actually, whatever that person has got has actually come from Krishna. So we have to recognize that there is, or at least we have to constantly introspect that there is a likelihood of element of envy. And that is what we would like to spend a few minutes on, that nature of envy and what we can do to minimize that. Because then we would be able to understand Krishna's activities and pastimes in the proper sense, and not just in a temporary or limited way. So if we look at the example of Daksha's story, because that is one of the many stories which give us this because he's, Daksha was perhaps one of the most powerful people at his time. Not only that, he was very good looking, to the extent that demigods were also serving him. And practically, if you have demigods bowing down to you, and then you have Lord Shiva as your son-in-law, Sati was his daughter. You can imagine his, and he was very charismatic, very powerful. He had everything, and yet, in his story, we won't go into the full details, but in his story, what was really upsetting him? If you go down to the root, he got extremely agitated because when he entered the assembly, everybody got up. And Lord Shiva was actually sitting down, his own son-in-law, but who was meditating on Lord Krishna. So he did not get up, and that really upset him to such an extent that he went into a tirade of blasphemy, spoke such ill will, so many bad things. Lord Shiva was not perturbed actually. It didn't bother him because he understood, he was above all this. But Sati wanted to later, when she wanted to go, she was very upset, but she later wanted to go to a sacrifice which her father was conducting. And Lord Shiva told her that he doesn't like me, so you should not go there because it will upset you. But she was saying, no, no, it's okay, I'll go. And because she had come there, so her father actually deliberately was very cruel to her by ignoring her and neglecting her completely. And that really, and she knew, she understood that because of her relationship with her master and her husband, Lord Shiva, that he is doing this. And she could not accept this, such an insult, the way he was treating her husband. And then with her powers, she put herself in blazes, set herself ablaze. And then Lord Shiva created this Veerbhadra, and he came and destroyed, and Daksha was vanquished. Then his Veerbhadra chopped off his head. Then he had a goat's head. So the conclusion was that after having everything, we discussed about the nature of envy, but here was an instance where somebody had, you cannot even imagine what he didn't have. He had practically everything. And yet, just the fact that he was envious of the worship that Lord Shiva was getting, that why he was not the highest. And he understood that Lord Shiva's, and it happened to be son-in-law, which made it probably more personal and more problematic. Because, you know, he didn't probably want that, you know, within the family, father-in-law is superior to the son-in-law, how he can get more service, more worship. So just that nature of not getting the fullest worship, even though he was getting such respect, completely destroyed his thinking, his mentality, and really brought out the worst in him, and then he met his destruction. So actually, what we don't have, you know, the nature of envy is that what we don't have, we just constantly meditate on that. We want what others have, and in that process, we actually lose what we have. So Prabhupada gives an example, analogy of a story, actually, example of a dog and the bone. He was saying that, you know, how a dog really, there was this dog which really somehow, after a lot of effort, got a bone, and he was very happy, he was holding on to it. And then he, we may not think bone is something, but for a dog, of course, it's a very relishable thing. So the dog came to a river, and then in the reflection, the dog saw another dog. It was his own reflection, but he didn't know that. So when he saw that other dog with another bone, he felt, I should have that. And then therefore the dog plunged into the water and he lost his bone. And so Prabhupada said, this is the nature of human beings and the nature of envy, that we want what others have, and in that process we also lose what we don't have. So basically, if we accept that principle of that Krishna is the proprietor, and our mood is to be a servant. Because as a servant, see, Srila Prabhupada once spoke, in fact, Giriraj Maharaj just, you know, in his blog, he last week only had brought this up. He said that, you know, he just gives up some something which, just a paragraph or two every few days on what Prabhupada he has just read about or he heard. So he spoke on envy and said Prabhupada gave the antidote to envy. He said that, If you simply accept Lord Chaitanya's philosophy, Krishna Jivara Sarupahoy Krishna Nityadas, that is the underlying principle for our relationships, that we are basically servants eternally. Because if we are servants, then we cannot, how can a servant, the servant's business is to serve, the servant's business is not to compete. So if the lack of that attitude is the root problem. So if we want to avoid envy, the servant cannot be envious. The servant is very happy and humble to get what he gets from his master. He feels he doesn't deserve that much. So therefore, concentrating on our own service is a key. Finding happiness in serving others and getting that that pleasure is actually, and to understand that is really Krishna's way of reciprocating with us, that he is giving us that highest pleasure and the taste in relishing that relationship. And it's a very satisfying feeling. So we may get it sometimes. So if we know that we've got it sometimes and we are not getting it other times, then it is our intelligence has to be used to know that what is it that I need to do to bring that focus of thinking, that thought constantly on when I am in my weaker moments, when I don't have that view of being a servant. So we may at times, may something upsets us and we get extremely agitated, and then we are intelligent enough to rationalize why we feel that. And in a rationalizing, we also try to say that I am doing my service. When we are criticizing someone, or we may not recognize the symptoms of anger and jealousy, but we may rationalize in that. So our intelligence has to be brought in, and that comes via constant touch with the words of Guru, Sadhu and Shastra, the scriptures, which could give us that understanding that if we deviate from the principle of being the servant, a true servant is just concentrating on his service, and any temporary setbacks, he just takes it in his or her stride and goes forward. This is Prabhupada's very all-complete explanation, but it is on a basic principle. Some years ago, there was a very nice presentation made on the nature of envy. I think it was Sanat Kumar Prabhu or Mulidhar Prabhu. I'm not absolutely sure, I forget, but it was very, very nice. And it was very practical. It went into more depth, and I wanted to share that with you because it will certainly help us also. So he said that first we should estimate the reality. For instance, what is the reality? That which are the areas we feel which cause envy? And typically they would fall into, for instance, somebody, it could be appreciation, means somebody is getting more appreciation than us. Somebody is getting more responsibility than us. Somebody has more facilities and enjoyment. Someone is getting more glorification than us. So, what are the, if we at least, so estimating the reality is a starting point. The reality is at least to ourselves internally that, okay, if it is a matter of responsibility, someone's getting more responsibility, and then we understand that is it maybe he has his talents, I have my talents, and we are doing our own way. So, we can do it separately. Somebody does it one way, somebody does another way. We discharge our responsibilities in a different way. But if we find that someone is actually having a higher, if we feel that his talent is more than mine, then we should say that I will serve him. I'll help him to achieve that. So the focus is on the service, not on the individual. But if we feel that I'm talented more, I could do it better than he, and he has a responsibility, then we have to understand that, try to train our mind into thinking that maybe because he's more trustworthy, he's more reliable, that is why he's doing that service. So this way we go for the principle. The principle here is that in responsibility it is who does the service better. The service is what's most important. How do we serve it better, rather than what I have to do. Similarly, if it is a matter of glorification, somebody is getting glorified, we say he deserves the praise. He or she deserves the praise, or he or she really deserves the respect, and I feel happy for him and for her. So we have to train our mind into thinking that, because even if we have conflicting views in our mind, but we have to trust the word of the scriptures rather than our mind. So that comes when we are familiar with what has been said, and at least let that voice of reason remain with us, which may be in serious conflict with our immediate desire, which is agitating us and which is wanting us to do something else. But if you were to listen to that voice of reason, it says that no, I may not be, just because I'm not getting glorification or I'm not being appreciated, doesn't mean that people don't like me. It's not that people don't accept me. But I really, if he's been or she's been appreciated or been glorified, very nice, I'm very happy for him. Similarly, if someone has more facilities and we are feeling that, oh, he doesn't deserve it, rather than that, if we think that, no, they, because he is able to use it well, therefore Krishna has given him that facility. So if we look at that way, then so here again the principle would be that try to use what we have well before we think what that I should have somebody what I don't have. So we have to see that whatever facilities we have been given, and we have a lot, there is never any 100%. There's always going to be hankering. But if we try to be content with what we have, and we have a lot actually if we look at it, you know, it's always a question of we look at what we don't have. But if we train ourselves to think what we have, then we'll be looking at it in a more positive way, that fully utilize it and use it in the proper way before thinking what I should have or others. What I don't have, I'm thinking of that. Because that will always be a fantasizing that, and that leads to a negative thought. It becomes a whole spiral reaction. So then he goes on to say that this estimation of reality is the first step. But assuming that you still feel envious after that, then the next step would be the what he says, the nurturing and neglecting. Because all the time, the important point is that we have to be in touch with ourselves and to know. You know, we may fool others, but we have to know where we stand. What is our inner feelings? We feel upset, angry, and then try to understand what is it that is upsetting me, angering me. So, nurturing and neglecting means you nurture your bhakti and neglect your envy. So you move to that stage that you, then let me concentrate on this principle that I just, again, it in a way it is doing a service. Nurturing your bhakti means what is my service? My service is to follow my regulative principles. It's a daily routine. Let me routinize what I'm doing. If I am under stress, what can I do to minimize that? In the sense that what is controllable, I should minimize. See, oftentimes we put so much time on uncontrollable factors and get really agitated. But what we are able to control, we neglect. Because we are able to control, or we should be trying to control, at least a focus our mind, our polish our intelligence, which we neglect. And we always look at things that... I wish this happens, I wish that happens, you know. If this happened, if that person had not done this, if this person didn't make a mistake, I could have got more rich, I could have done this. So many things, you know, we are looking at things which are not in our control. So therefore, if we were to nurture our own bhakti and neglect the envy, so the point of raising is that we have to actually say this to ourselves and act on that. So acting on it is the most important part. So therefore it has to be uppermost in our mind. And even if we don't, even after that, and for that we have to be very vigilant. Vigilant means watchful. We have to constantly watch for signs of how our mind is working. And watchful that, if we are neglecting our services, this immediately, it's a moment by moment thing. It's not that for some time you feel nice, you know, you've gone on a 5-day association, maybe yatra with a group of people, and it's a extremely nice atmosphere, very sattvic, and you have got a lot of services, the whole tempo is set, very nice. And you come back and then you think that I'm now set. It's not like that. It is a moment to moment. I mean, we could just, within a moment, go back. Mind can travel faster than the wind, can completely change our thinking. So that risk is always there. So we have to be very watchful. And he mentioned that one easy way to know, to remember this, is that the word envy, E-N-V-Y, envy. So phonetically, when you are pronouncing it, it is alphabetically N-V. N-V, the letter N and V, if you say N-V, and that N-V stands for no vacancy. No vacancy in the spiritual world. So it's a short form of remembering that N-V means, if you think of not the word but the letters, then it will be easy to remember that no vacancy in the spiritual world. The minute I am having that kind of feeling, means I am not going to be having a ticket. I need not even stand in the queue, because that is not even allowed. So, and the last point is that we need to yearn. Yearn means deep, having a deep desire. This is supposing we still have envy. We have gone through this, and we may not have gone through this, whatever, but at this stage we may have superficially gone through it, but we are still having feeling envy. Then at least we should yearn, means to have a deep, deep desire to overcome this and to be engaged in service constantly. So, at least we should have the courage to not avoid this. Temptation is to not look at our own weaknesses. This is a very, because it's very unpleasant, avoidable thing. We would like to be in a very pleasant atmosphere, see, only look at the good things. Externally, internally also. Whenever something nice has happened to us, somebody recognizes us, or we feel we have done something nice, we did something either deliberately or accidentally, and it clicks, and it works well, and pleases others, and we are so happy, excited. We also see, we get more excited when other people see this. So we are in that mood. But when something goes wrong, rarely do we want to, not that we have to brood over it to the extent of depression, but actually to rectify it. And we are not talking of mistake, means you, instead of serving the plate, you, something falls on someone's foot. And those kind of slips are small. But these are more subtle issues which are which we try to avoid. We do not want to meditate on that. This is where our challenge is. So the reason for understanding our nature is that we need that. Because it's not so obvious oftentimes that how the element of envy actually is the root. Because where there's envy, there is where there's pride, there is envy. And why there is pride? Because we always think we are the doer. If we see, there are two things: either we accept Krishna as God and proprietor in the fullest sense, means in every aspect of life, and we just and not just mechanically, but we, with eyes open, and we are constantly seeing in Krishna's manifestation in everything that happens. Even if something doesn't happen the way we want, we say, see, Krishna is teaching me, I am not in control. So when we see Krishna's manifestation, everything, or we should know that we are actually, in a sense, competing with God. Because the nature of our mind is either I am God or Krishna is God. There is somebody who is going to be God. I am God means I am the controller, I am the doer, and I am. And when we see that, when I have done something and the effect is there, you see that the pride also will also usually rise with your status and relationships. The more you really find, there will always be some pride, but you really find a beggar will having so much pride compared to someone who is, you know, at a very high level materially. Why? Because when you have success and you feel you are the doer, you have seen the results. You see that, well, I did this and I got this. And because I have done it, therefore I am in control, I know how to do it. I am, and that gives us that impression, and which makes us compete with God. And what is Krishna's attitude? Krishna is actually most, you know, compassionate, and he wants us to come with him, but he will, in his loving way, he will allow us to make our own mistakes. So if we accept the principle that we are the servant, we are always Nitya Das, then Krishna will actually fill us with his love, and otherwise he will just withdraw his yoga maya potency and give us the let us be in the Bhayananga Shakti, the Mahamaya potency. And then we are, you know, going through these dualities and challenges and anxieties and so on. So, real intelligence is someone who actually understands and once understanding, then always wants to be in touch with the reality of what where we stand. Knowing that is a moment-to-moment process, knowing that there is a risk, and I can be derailed any time. So the maintenance of the rail system is similar to maintenance of our own. It has to be well oiled by the words of wisdom in the shastras constantly. So then, if we keep on maintaining it well, then our consciousness also will give us this protection of knowing our true position, and in which case we would not be having the symptoms of envy, and which would really allow us to actually relish the nectar of not just the pastimes, which are relatively more complex to appreciate and understand, but even all aspects of spiritual life. So that's the difference really between when I see, so you wonder sometimes, you know, that how people are able to spend hours listening to katha, or I hear somebody read 6 hours a day, 4 hours a day, and I wonder, I mean, when will I reach that 4 hours a day, 6 hours a day, every day? And it's not that it's like giving an exam. Some people may study for their medical exam because they have to appear. So that's out of fear. This is something out of they relish it. They have trained themselves, but then they really relish. So why is it? Then we can see that because they have reached the stage where they are not in competition with the Lord. So therefore the Lord is sharing His love with him. And because He is sharing His love, then they are able to see how glorifying in their relationship as a servant. And it's a perfect match. The perfect master and the perfect servant, and then they are eternally together. So we'll stop here. Are there any comments or questions? Time is up, but so Granth Sahib Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai.